Thank you. Be seated.
May it please the court, Mr. Kyle Rundle will present arguments of the petitioner. Petitioners have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you for the privilege of appearing before you, and if it pleases the court. Federal Safety Standard 208, Section 4.5.3, grants manufacturers the option to install a passive two-point belt system that meets the performance requirements of S5.1 in place of a lap belt.
For all purposes or only for certain types of collisions?
For all purposes, Your Honor. There's never been a distinction drawn as far as the Hernandez Gomez case.
Would you do me a favor in that regard? I hate to interrupt what your initial comments were, but you brought it up, and I just can't figure this out. If you would, do you have a copy of the standard?
I do.
The regulation?
I do.
Would you? I've read and reread what I call S4.5.3,
yes,
and I cannot find in there where it allows you to have the type of seat belt, a non-lap belt. Where does it say in there that you can have this type of automatic belt without a lap belt?
Well, you have to read it in conjunction with S.1.2.2.
Okay.
4.5.3 says that you can install a system that meets the performance requirements of one of the three options,
right,
in place of the belt otherwise required by the option. You turn to S4.1.2.2 and you see that there are type 1 or type 2, type 1 being a lap belt, belts otherwise required. So when you put the two provisions together, it's clear that the belts that 4.5.3 says that you can install the automatic belt system in place of are the lap belt required otherwise by that second option. And just to continue, I don't know if you'd like me to continue to walk through that regulation. It is set forth in our briefs at some length and in the O'Brien case. But I do want to add that there is no doubt that those sections mean what they say, because in 1974, NHTSA ruled that 4.5.3 authorized the VW system, the two-point belt system, to satisfy the requirements of option two, that's 1.2.2, and to replace the required seat belt assemblies. And it went on to say that option two exists precisely, quote, to accommodate the passive restraint system, systems like VWs, and that's at 39 Federal Register 3834.
Where under 4.1.2.2 does it say that you can have one without a lap belt?
Well, 2.2?
Yes.
I'm sorry. It's 74.1.1.2. Okay.
.1.1.2?
Right. It's the second option.
And there, where does it say it can be without a lap belt?
It doesn't. 4.5.3 does. 4.1.1.
No, 4.5.3 doesn't say anything about being able to have a belt without a lap belt. When I asked you about it initially, you sent me to 4.1.2.1.
Yeah. Let me try it again.
Okay.
4.5.3,
yes,
says that a belt assembly that requires no action, that's a passive,
right,
system, may be used to meet the protection requirements of any option and in place of any seatbelt assembly otherwise required by that option.
Right.
Okay, you turn to 4.1.1.2,
okay,
and it will say that there is a seatbelt assembly, type 1 or 2, type 1 is a lap belt, that is otherwise required by that option. So when you put those two provisions together, 4.5.3 says you do not have to have, you can put in place of, that lap belt otherwise required by the option, a system that meets the performance requirements of that option, and the performance requirements of that option are set forth in 5.1.
So what you're saying is that the option that you are entitled to is any option that you can come up with that satisfies the performance requirements.
No, I'm saying that the option that we have is to use an automatic seat belt in place of the belts otherwise required by the option, so long as that automatic seat belt meets the performance requirements of that option.
All right. And on just for my clarity one more time, under 4.1.1.2, it doesn't have anything in there about any type of belt that does not have a lap belt.
That's correct, because it says that you have to have a lap belt, but 4.5.3 says in place of that lap belt, you can put an automatic belt system in that satisfies the performance requirements of 4.1.1.2.
And those performance requirements that are referenced there are frontal collision requirements and one other type of collision, but it doesn't provide any performance requirements for a rollover.
Well, that is true. There is no test in respect to rollover, but the same is also true of option 3, which is the manual seatbelt options. There's no provisions in there for any rollover test. For years and years and years, it has been held that that option is available for all purposes, in all crashes, without any limit, no exception.
Okay.
And in fact, the rule has been, no case has ever held otherwise, that all those options are alternatives to each other, and each is available for all cars, for all crashes, without exception. No case prior to Hernandez-Gomez has ever held otherwise.
Mr. Elbrun, this is a case only involving a claim of implied preemption, isn't it?
No, Your Honor. It is also a case involving a claim of express preemption, although implied preemption was the focus of the case in the trial court and through the time that Cipollone came down.
What about the point that your adversaries make on page 15 of their brief, where they cite from your brief in the Court of Appeals saying that Hyundai does not contend that plaintiff's claims are expressly preempted?
Yeah, if you look at, I take Your Honor's point, it's very fair, but if you look at what was presented to the trial court, you'll see in the motion that the body of authority that had to do with express preemption was all cited before the court. And when you look to the Court of Appeals decision, you will see that it holds both in respect to express and implied preemption, so it was clear that the issue was before it and was in fact argued before it. Let me say this one thing further that follows up, I believe, on Your Honor's question. NHTSA determined that those options, all of them, ought to exist to give manufacturers the flexibility and latitude that those options gave it, and it was in particular concerned about that flexibility and latitude in respect to choice between various passive restraint options. It reasoned that mandating a single choice of passive restraint risked killing or seriously retarding development of passive restraint systems. And so it said, and I'm quoting from its brief in several cases, that a common law rule that punished a manufacturer for choosing one passive restraint option instead of another would, quote, deserve the safety purposes of the act and drastically, that's a quote, interfered with them. So that those options, all of them, and the flexibility and latitude that they provide are, the case law has held basically universally, an essential element of the regulatory framework. So a common law claim that had the effect, as this one does, of taking away that option by punishing its exercise after the fact would frustrate the regulatory framework. And Pokorny and Taylor and Mars, the Court of Appeals in Texas, long line of 208 authority, says that.
Can the Perry versus Mercedes-Benz case be distinguished?
Yes, Your Honor, I think this case is actually opposite to Perry, and I'll give that a whirl if I can. Perry did not attack the manufacturer's choice of the authorized 208 airbag option. Instead, Perry said a part of the system that you installed, the airbag, was defective because it didn't inflate when it should. This is the opposite case. Plaintiff attacks Hyundai's choice of that two-point belt system without lap belts and does not say that there was any part, which is authorized by 208, and does not say that any part of that authorized system was defective. For example, doesn't say that the belt buckle didn't hold.
Well, that the airbag in Perry met the minimum performance standards.
Well, actually,
according to the Fifth Circuit's opinion.
Yes, but the system itself was not attacked. The fact that the manufacturer had the option to install that airbag system was not the subject of attack. And had it been, Perry's pretty clear that that attack would have been preempted.
But isn't the claim essentially the same here?
Isn't
the claim essentially the same here? That they're saying that this two-point seatbelt system met the minimum performance requirements, but it was nevertheless defective because it did not have another component to prevent.
Well, I think what they're really doing is attacking the option. Okay.
Well, let me just say that if their pleadings could be read to say that the system itself was defective, even though it met minimum performance requirements, would that be a different case?
Well, it's not this case. They said in their pleadings that what was wrong with the system was it didn't have a lap belt. Absolutely crystal clear, that's what they said. The option that Hyundai exercised authorized it to install this system without a lap belt. So the design defect that they say exists is that the system did not have the lap belt that the option authorized it not to have. Consequently, the attack upon that design is necessarily an attack upon the option.
Well, couldn't you make the same argument about the airbag? The airbag, the regulations say that it has to meet certain minimum requirements. And the argument in that case was, yes, it met the minimum requirements, but it was still defective. Isn't it the same type of argument?
You could make the same argument if they were making it. That is to say, if they were saying the belt was no good because it didn't hold at 12 miles an hour, which was the Perry case, that would be an analogous system, charge. But they're not saying that. They're saying the evil is that this system did not have the lap belt that the option authorized it not to have. And consequently, this is an attack upon that option that authorizes that system. And more to the point, ultimately, it would have exactly the same effect that the 208 authority condemns. That is, it would punish the exercise of that option authorizing that system after the fact, so in effect take it away, therefore limit the element of choice that is essential to the regulation and consequently is flatly in conflict with it, therefore it is preempted.
Does the savings clause do anything but show that Congress did not intend to exhaust the field?
Not in our view, Your Honor. In our view, and in the view of the overwhelming body of 208 case law, which is more to the point, that savings clause operates to save claims that do not conflict with the statute that the clause is a part of, but not claims that do. And it is instead a clause whose purpose is to ensure that somebody can't claim that Congress has occupied the field. Now, that principle has been recited in 208 after 208 case, and I'm going to quote from Corney that says, it's out of the Third Circuit, it is well established that a savings clause like 1397K does not save common law actions that would subvert a federal statute or regulatory scheme. Now, that case law relies upon quotations, among others, from Ouellette and from Morales, exactly the case authority that this court relied on in the Continental Airlines case just a few months ago when it cited and quoted from both Ouellette and Morales. So the principle and the line of authority that commands it is well known to this court.
Is it still your contention that the savings clause makes the statute ambiguous?
Well, we'll take it two ways. After SIP alone, it's very clear that the express preemption argument has force, tremendous force, because the word standard does not distinguish between positive enactment and the common law, just like the word requirement did not in SIP alone. And when you take Medtronic, that just came down, that says that a preemption clause analogous to ours preempts any conflicting state regulation, you can stop right there. It's expressly preempted, and indeed nine cases under 208 arising after SIP alone have so held. But if you do not buy that argument, what happens is that you take the savings clause and you juxtapose it to the preemption clause, and the two send, as the circuit court said, conflicting messages, with the consequence that there is no reliable indicium of congressional intent in the language of SIP alone in the statute, with the consequence that implied preemption analysis is compelled, and when you get to implied preemption analysis, it's clear that this common law claim has to fall because that common law claim flatly conflicts with the regulation and the essential purpose of the regulation to ensure the element of choice in respect to passive restraint options.
Any other questions?
Yes, one more, and that is, I saw in your briefing several lines of testimony from one of your experts that you set forth as satisfying your summary judgment proof that the restraint system that you chose complied with the federal regulations. And I don't recall which of your briefs that was in, but hopefully you recall what I'm talking about.
Yes.
Is that your only summary judgment proof that the restraint system that you utilized satisfy the federal regulations?
Well, it's actually a double-barreled proof, and it's their expert and not our expert.
Okay.
Their expert says, in deposition, it's a transcript 166 to 167, statement of facts, 166 to 167, says it complied. Yes, it complied. He also says that Hyundai had certified that system as complying. And that certification by itself is sufficient to establish compliance, and indeed does, across the entire country. And in fact, that was the proof of compliance and the only proof of compliance that existed in the Volkswagen case in O'Brien. So the answer is, clean, that the system complied.
One other question, somewhat in that regard, and that is, do you claim that the option that Hyundai chose is inherently permissible, or is it your claim that it is permissible because it is similar or identical to the VW system, and the VW system has been deemed permissible?
Our position is that it's authorized by 4.5.3, just like the VW option is, because they are essentially the same, although the Hyundai option is an improvement. But the analysis that we went through at the very beginning of the argument obtains, and it obtains both as to the VW system and our system, which is very much like it, although an improvement.
Could you, before you sit down, can you address, I'm sure, what the argument, anticipate the argument of the opponents is, the court gives conclusion that regardless of what option you chose, the defect is that the restraint does not work, period.
Well,
it's defective because it does not restrain.
Well,
that's a defect.
The defect that was charged is that it didn't have a lap belt.
No, not according to the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals concludes that the problem with the system is that it doesn't work.
Well, let me say two things about that, if I may. I'm sorry to shed light on, but if you look at transcript 118, 129, 140, 151, 110, 223, 228, it's clear that what we're talking about is a charge that there is no lap belt. Now, with respect to whether it restrains, that is a federal call. federal government has said that all of these options are alternatives, one to the other. When NHTSA set them out, it set them out as alternatives to one another because, necessarily, they met the requirement of the Act, they are safe and meet the need for safety. So that when NHTSA granted that option, it has said, that's a safe system, and the state cannot second guess it. Because if it does, it's going to take that option away, and in NHTSA's words, disturb the clause of safety.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you very much.
The court is ready to hear argument and response.
May it please the court, Ms. Hamilton will present argument to the respondent.
I'd like to introduce my client, Mario Alvarado, to the respondent. Today, the incident question, Mario was wearing his seatbelt, the automobile rolled, and he was ejected through the sunroof. And I know the court is aware of that. I had prepared some materials, demonstrative exhibits, and I gave each of you copies. It turned out the ones I prepared weren't big enough to speak to the bench, but some of your questions, you just throw them away. We don't need to refer to them at all. I also provided the court with a copy of the legislative history, and I think I want to change my outline of my argument to address initially Judge Abbott's question, because when I heard him ask him, I realized we could cut to the chase on something. Under tab 8 of the legislative materials, I have the complete regulations of standards 208 and 209 as well, from 1988, from the CFR from 1988. And I had concluded yesterday I wouldn't go into detail on the issue of whether or not a lap belt was required. The court will see it's very technical, and you have to read not just 4.1.2.1-3, and I'm not stringing out a bunch of numbers to make it sound worse than it is. I mean, you have to read those. You have to read 5.3. You also have to read 209. And 209 defines pelvic restraint, by the way, as not necessarily a lap belt, but a device that is in contact with the pelvic region at all times. Now, all that notwithstanding, Mr. Heilbronn is correct about NHTSA. I don't know that NHTSA issued a ruling. I know there was a letter from NHTSA saying that the DW system, they aren't going to issue a ruling saying it satisfied the requirements, but that the passive two-point restraint system fell within 5.3. Regardless of that, and I'm certainly not saying disregard NHTSA, I would say that the statute is really ambiguous about whether a lap belt is required.
You mean the regulation?
Yes, I'm sorry. Standard 208 is ambiguous about whether a lap belt is required under these circumstances. And that if it's ambiguous, really presumption against preemption counsels against finding it. But for purposes of my argument, I'm happy to address the issue of if the lap belt is not required. And again, it's a very long technical argument. The materials you need are here, but at any rate. When I had an outline for my argument, what I was going to begin by saying is that this case operates at two levels. There's a simple level and a complicated level. Both levels are very interesting to me. At the simple level are issues of summary judgment, procedure, and burden of proof. And as to that, there's two issues I'd like to raise. Hyundai's motion for summary judgment, and it was a motion for partial summary judgment as the trial court, is premised on two assumptions. One is that plaintiffs are attacking the option they chose rather than the design they chose to implement the option. And the other assumption is that Hyundai provided evidence of compliance, which, as this court noted in Redmond, is necessary. The plaintiffs have taken a position all the way from the trial court today, including their response to the motion for partial summary judgment, that we are attacking the design Hyundai chose and not the option.
And in what respect are you attacking the design other than it doesn't have a lap belt?
Okay. I have that addressed right here, Your Honor. Here we go. If you go back to the trial court level, at issue was the Second Amendment petition, motion for partial summary judgment, and our response. Those pleadings put into issue the following claims. Defective design because of no manual lap belt, defective design because of no passive lap belt. And just as an aside, Hyundai claims in one of its papers that no one knew about the passive lap belt in ADA. And that's not correct. In the legislative materials I gave you, Elizabeth Dole's final report, when she was Secretary of DOT, which was in 1984, specifically states passive lap belts are an option. And I have sites for that that I'll put in the letter. The next claim was negligence because no passive lap belt, no manual lap belt. There were also the inadequate warnings and inadequate instruction claims. But then there was a third claim, defective design of the passive restraint system in that it failed to provide adequate restraint in the event of a rollover.
But is it your contention in that regard that the only way it could have is if there had been a lap belt?
No, now again, this was summary judgment and it was not fleshed out at trial, but there are other methods of restraint. For example, not putting a sunroof over a seat that has no lap belt.
What is the posture of this case? This was partial summary judgment. The case was refiled and tried. If this court agrees with the Court of Appeals, do you have another trial?
Let me answer that as best I can. As I said, the case operates at two levels, simple and complicated, and I'm pigeonholing. Procedural aspect is simple. That's obviously not accurate. Procedurally, there is a nightmare here, but it's my understanding if this court were to rule for us and the summary judgment were reversed, in theory, it could go back to Webb County and be tried. Now, there was, as the court is well aware, another trial in Duval County where these claims are raised again, and it is on appeal to the San Antonio Court because I believe they've evaded any decision-making process until the court here decides.
Was that issue that's here tried in the other county?
No. In fact, plaintiff's counsel, and I was not trial counsel, Mr. Hastings was, but they were very careful at the trial in Duval County to make sure that everything that was addressed by the partial summary judgment was not tried there. And they went to the extent of having the jury charge tell the jury you cannot consider lack of a manual lap belt. So those narrow issues are not an issue in Duval.
Just one issue of this partial summary judgment can be retried if the Court of Appeals decision stands in Webb County all by itself, regardless of what happened in the other county.
Your Honor, yes, and I don't mean to be raising rabbit trails here, but if there is the issue that there was a non-suit after this, so I don't know, once it went back to Webb County, what the effect of the non-suit would be. But I would think, because the non-suit was decided, this could be retried in Webb County.
I thought our second opinion, or our first opinion in this, said that that issue was over.
Right.
As far as for purposes of deciding it in an appellate process.
Exactly. Now, if this goes back...
So let's just assume the other way, that the Court of Appeals had decided in Hyundai's favor, and we did too, then that's a dead issue then.
Correct.
Because of this appellate process here, regardless of what happened in the other lawsuit, in that opinion.
That's correct, in that the manual lap belt claim would be resolved forever. Now, there are separate claims in Duval County that will have to be addressed. It's unfortunate that it's split apart like that, but it is.
I asked you how your design claims involve anything other than the absence of the lap belt. You told me about, I think, about seven of them.
Yeah.
The ones that do, if not all of them do, at least the ones that do, say that the design is faulty because there's no lap belt. Why isn't that attacking the choice that the standard 208 gives, which is what the petitioner complains about?
Okay, and you can tell you what you're asking. Let me re-characterize and tell me if I'm wrong. What you're asking is why are the claims as to no lap belt, why are they not attacking the option?
Yes.
All right. The first answer to that is the very lengthy issue of whether Hyundai is correct that 5.3 does not require a lap belt. The statute is unclear on that issue. The NHTSA ruling has some effect on it, but the language of the standard and the statute considered together, it does not say you can't have a lap belt. So first of all, there's the issue of whether they could even comply with the option without the lap belt. Now, there's a second issue. It's I guess what you could call the Hernandez-Gomez issue, which is, have they even complied with the standard appropriate here, which is the rollover standard? And again, this goes to the complexity of the standards. If you look under tab 8 in legislative history, you will see that there is a provision called rollover. So you could say that the standards do include a rollover standard. And I believe that's 208 S5-3. Let me, here it is, S5-3. It says rollover. Subject a vehicle to a rollover test under the applicable condition of S8 in either lateral direction, so on and so forth, so that the all portions of the test dummy are contained within the vehicle. Now, everyone in this case, Hyundai and plaintiffs, have assumed that even though the standard contains that provision and did in 1988, NHTSA was not enforcing it. And we attached in our response to summary judgment testimony from Mr. Ian Jones, who was a witness for Hyundai. We said, in Section 208, as far as compliance testing is concerned, the only compliance testing that's required for a passive system is the front impact test, correct? And Mr. Jones, speaking for Hyundai, said, that's my understanding, yes. And he went on to say that when asked, so saying that you comply with 208 does not necessarily mean that the system performs well in rollovers, and he said, that's right. So all parties have assumed there is no rollover standard, even though 5.3 seems to indicate that there is. Either way, if what Hyundai is arguing is correct, then car manufacturers have no duty to design against rollovers. And I don't think that the Safety Act, which was passed for consumer safety, intended that. And just to pick up on may digress, have I answered your question? If I can digress. I gave y'all in the legislative history the complete legislative debates, the Senate debates, the Senate report, the House debate, the House report. I also gave you other materials through the final ruling in 1984. And I did that because this law has been around for so long. It's been around for 30 years. And there's a lot of law interpreting it, and there's a lot of famous politicians in this country who've talked about it. If you read the legislative history, it's fascinating. It's a roll call of America's politicians on both sides, Republican, Democrat, liberal, conservative, and from Texas, Tower, Krueger, Eckhart, former Justice Gamage of this court, Representative Collins from Texas, Kennedy, Javits, Ribicoff, Magnuson, Moss. These are great men. You may not agree with them, but they're great men, and they gave it a lot of thought. These debates are lengthy, and people are speaking about subjects they've thought about a great deal. And in that regard, I've taken out some quotes on two issues in particular. One, whether they intended the common law to be preempted. And two, whether the term standard is meant to include common law. Whether the standard is a performance standard or a design standard. And I will send a letter to the court with the precise page that I'm reading from so that you can read it in context, because what you're going to find is, and this goes to the issue of whether the savings clause conflicts with the preemption clause and whether it creates an ambiguity, it really doesn't. When you go back to 66 and you move forward in time, they never intended the common law to preempt. Now that doesn't mean that under the prong of preemption test, the implied preemption test, it doesn't affect the issue about whether the regular standard may conflict with federal law. But in terms of the intent of Congress, they did not intend to preempt the common law.
Let me be sure I'm clear on that.
Sure.
Your view is that if this was just a straight case, you should have had a laptop, period.
If this were a straight case, Your Honor?
If the plaintiff's claim was there should have been a laptop.
Among other claims, yes.
No, I'm saying, assuming that's the only claim,
okay,
just a straightforward claim, sure you had all these other things, but you should have had a lap band.
Yes.
Like you should have had an air band. That your view is that the statute does not preempt the common law, preempt common law liability in those cases.
I understand where you're going with that. I hesitate because this is not like the airbag cases where plaintiffs are saying, I didn't even wear my seatbelt, but you should have had an airbag there. That's not what this is about. all three options, in my opinion, require a lap belt. And reasonable minds may differ on that. We have the NHTSA letter saying...
But if we decide that against you...
Correct.
Your view still is there should be common law liability.
Absolutely. And I know that's a controversial conclusion, and what I would like... on my part, at any rate. And what I would like to do is read some of the quotes, and then if y'all have the time and interest to go back and read this, you will find that in context, this does in fact reflect the sentiment of Congress. Here's House report at page 24, and this is, I'm taking them out of chronological order, but you'll see. This is under tab 4 in the legislative history. Section 108C of the reported bill provides that compliance with any federal motor vehicle standards does not exempt a person from liability under common law. It is intended, and this subsection specifically establishes, that compliance with safety standards is not to be a defense or otherwise to affect the rights of parties under common law, particularly those relating to warranty contract and tort liability. Now, this is the House report, and the Senate's version of the bill was the one enacted. However, after both bills were considered, there was a session to resolve differences between the two bills, and in fact, it was the House's clause that was enacted. So this is some, this is at least half of Congress's intent as to whether or not common law was preempted. Also, at the House debate, Representative Tip O'Neill felt there should be criminal penalties for not complying with the standards. And Representative Dingell said, no, that's not necessary because we don't need criminal penalties because we have preserved every single common law remedy that exists against a manufacturer for the benefit of a motor vehicle purchaser. This means all of the warranties and all of the other common law, all the other devices of common law which are afforded to the purchaser remain in the buyer and they can be exercised against the manufacturer. Now, the Wood case, which was the first of these cases, said, well, when they were talking about that, we didn't really have product liability claims for defective design. About Larson. So one of the things I did is I read subsequent legislative discussions on those points. There are also from the Senate debates, I just add, there are similar quotes about common law. Compliance with federal standards would not necessarily shield any person from broad liability in common law. Common law and product liability still remains as it was. But if you move forward in time to the Department of Transportation report, which is 1977, Brock Adams speaking, and was questioned by Mr. Lugin before the House of Representatives. And Mr. Lugin said, on insurance, have there been any objections made with reference to the availability of product liability? I'm talking about past constraints. Secretary Adams said, automobile companies have indicated an objection, but the insurance companies indicated that considering the other product liability factors in the car, this is not a major factor, and all state insured, and he's talking about the demonstration fleet, they were used for the passive system, and this guy interrupts him and says, but that didn't cost them a nickel, they didn't provide coverage. And Adams says, I'm talking about the insurance companies, but all state agreed to insure the demonstration fleet. He says, insure the demonstration fleet? Says, yes, the fleet that was being produced with the airbag. This guy says, product liability? And Adams says yes. Then Elizabeth Dole's report, her final ruling, she herself says, some commentators, and this is 1984 now, some commentators suggested that the manufacturers would use the cheapest system to comply with an automatic restraint requirement. The department does not agree with this contention. It believes that competition, potential liability for deficient systems of pride in one's product would prevent this. And there's other...
No, deficient, I mean...
I'm sorry.
Couldn't deficient systems that you had that in your brief refer to one that does not work?
Yes.
I mean...
It could.
Just in terms of it, right, in use or doesn't withstand impact.
It could, and reading it out of context, isolated, that's certainly a plausible and reasonable interpretation. When you read it in the report, following up on, and if you don't mind, I'm sorry to be reading from here, so just real briefly, there's other things in the report that make it clear that what they're talking about are product liability.
If you submit all this in a letter brief, we'll read it, but your time is ticking away.
I know. I'm trying to move along. I'll send that. The other issue that dovetails with this is the standard issue, whether the standard is a design or performance standard. And on that issue, and also whether standard includes common law. On those two issues, throughout the legislative history, the word standard is used over 1,000 times. I counted in one four-page range, it was used 100 times. Not once is it ever used to refer to common law standards. Every single time it's used to refer to federal and administrative regulations and promulgation. Also, it's reiterated throughout the history from 66 all the way through 88, that it is a performance standard and not a design standard. Rather than read, continue, I'll just send that in as well. Now, another aspect to Hyundai's claim that the Safety Act preempts plaintiff's claims is that we are trying to apply a non-identical standard to the same aspect of performance. And this is what Justice Heck
Are there any questions?
Thank you. Thank you for your time.
Very briefly, as to these being performance, not design standards, as Wood said, 208 has elements of a design standard. That's one of the reasons why it's unique in the Safety Act and in Safety Act litigation. With respect to the word standard, the Supreme Court case law makes clear that it includes common law standards. With respect to legislative history, the remarks from Mr. Dingell that were quoted were explained in the Wood case long ago, and we're not really writing on a blank slate here, those remarks had to do with enforcement of the federal standards by common law, not with enforcement of conflicting standards. And as Wood explained, there is nothing in the legislative history that says anything about Congress being interested in preserving conflicting common law design.
How do you enforce federal standards with common law?
Real simple. You just say that it doesn't meet the federal standard, and as a consequence, it's defective.
Wouldn't that be applying the federal standard, federal regulation, the federal law, as opposed to enforcing common law or applying common law?
Well, the common law claim would be based upon that federal standard. In accordance with the general evidentiary rule, that the failure to comply with government standards as evidence of negligence or defect.
Okay. What about the reference to the rollover standard?
Reference to the rollover standard?
Yes, in 208, I think it was.
Yeah. That reference to the rollover standard had to do with the rollover protocol that has to do with an option different from the one that we exercise. It has to do with option one, not option two. So it really has nothing to do with the case that we're talking about. I'd like to say a couple things further about the rollover issue. Number one, Dykema and O'Brien are rollover cases. They deal with exactly the system that we're talking about here. So as a Pocornia rollover case, it deals with a different system. And ultimately, in the end, and this is the point I'm going to stress, it's unprincipled to make preemption turn upon the fortuity of the kind of accident that you're talking about. Because the principle that you're supposed to be looking at is whether or not the common law claim, if allowed, will frustrate the regulatory framework. The constitutional precept is real clear. This court quoted it in Moore. State law is preempted if it stands as an obstacle to the full purposes and objectives of federal law. It frustrates the federal law. Unyielding line of authority is held without exception that claims like this one do.
That's why they're preempted. Was this court's decision in Moore wrong?
Well, this court's decision in Moore, I frankly think it's wrong, but it doesn't matter if it's wrong or right as far as this analysis is concerned. In Moore, of course, there was no regulation in place. Here there is a regulation in place. So there is a conflict. Moore was primarily an express preemption case. We've talked a lot about implied preemption here. And when Moore went off and said it was not going to find implied preemption there, it referred to its footnote 10, and its footnote 10 was based upon Myrick 1, and as to Myrick 1 and the principle relied upon by Moore in it, the Supreme Court in Myrick 2 said, that's bad law. It has no merit.
Is the Arizona case, your name, has petition for cert been filed in that case?
Not to my knowledge. Not to my knowledge.
So you're saying that the main difference between Moore and this case is that in Moore there was no regulation involved?
I'm saying that's one difference, but the other difference is that it's clear here that what you've got is a claim that frustrates the regulation that grants options, because it takes one of the options in way, away, and there were no options in play anymore.
Any other questions?
I do have a question. She cited us to S5.3, and you say that that applies to a different option. Can you tell me the text where it says that?
Yeah. I think that she miscited, if I may, with all respect, to say so. I think she was talking about 4.5.3, but she referred to 5.3. If she's talking about the rollover protocol, which is 5.3, it's referred to in 4.1. I better, can I have a chance to get this real right? I want to make sure I hit the right one this time. It is referred to, in 4.1.2.1.
I'm sorry, would you tell me that one more time?
Yeah. 4.1.2.1C1. And we're talking about 4.1.2.2 and the interface between it and 4.5.3.
I'm just talking about 5.3.
Right. 5.3 is referred to in 4.1.2.1C1, which is not an option we're talking about here because we didn't exercise it. We'll be happy to do that, Your Honor. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, Your Honor. That concludes the argument on the second call. The court will take another.
The audience will please rise.